So, welcome to this public lecture. My name is Hyun Bang Shin, professor of geography and urban studies in the Department of Geography and Environment, where I'm also acting as the head of department. So, we are very much privileged to have Professor Laura Pulido in this public lecture, which is going to be looking at white nationalism and GOP climate obstruction. And I have to say, for those of you who are less familiar to the U.S. context, and I guess you might wonder what GOP means. GOP standing for Grand Old Party, which is a nickname for Republican Party. So hopefully that is registered on your head before you listen to Laura. Laura has been a world-renowned expert in the areas of critical human geography, ethnic studies, and environmental justice. Quite a rare combination to have those aspects of race, ethnic inquiries combined with environmental awareness and looking into this from a very critical perspective. So we are very happy to have her today. She's currently a Collins Chair and also Professor of Indigenous Race and Ethnic Studies and Geography at the University of Oregon. And because of her expertise and her reputation, we are very privileged to have her here at the LSE as the Centennial Professor in the Department of Geography and Environment, also in the Finland, United States, in the center as well. She'll be speaking for about 45 to 50 minutes. This is going to be recorded, and hopefully, assuming that there's no technical failure, it'll be made available at a later date as a podcast. If you're on X or former Twitter, the event hashtag for today's event is LSE event. That's quite simple. Please do spread the word on your X account or Instagram, whatever you use, to share the wisdom with the wider world. I think that's all we covered. And in case of fire, by the way, just remain calm, follow the instruction coming from all other members of staff here. There's gathering point is outside the building, just in front of the Lincoln's Inn field. So just to remember, that's where we are to meet in case of fire, and if you have to evacuate, and we'll touch you, it doesn't come to that. So without further ado, well, let me invite Professor Laura Pulido for the lecture. Thanks.
Thank you. Hi, can you hear me in the back? Good? All right.
Excellent.
So thank you very much for that generous introduction, and it has been a real pleasure and learning experience to be here at the LSE, learning about another institution, how another higher ed education works in the UK, and meeting lots of wonderful people and great students. When people ask me about, like, what's it like there, like, the students are really good. Before I get started in my formal presentation, I'd like to talk a little bit about how I got into this particular topic, a little bit of background about it. As Kyun said in his introduction, I sit at the intersection of ethnic studies and geography. And where I sit in my corner of the world, what I saw is a whole lot of work around climate that's falling into two kind of arenas. On the one hand, there's a lot of work that documents the racially uneven outcomes of climate change, as well as other forms of environmental hazards and problems. And on the other side, there's a lot of work that really celebrates and elevates the work of Black, Indigenous, and people of color involved in climate struggles. And I'm really also drawing on some of the work here of Tiana Bruno, my former student here, who earlier was giving a talk here at LSE. And I myself have contributed to this work, and so I certainly think it's very important work. But I also, in the last several years, the truth is I've also been very disheartened. And this really started when Trump announced his first candidacy in 2015. And I watched what he did over the course of his tenure in office, the various racist things they did, as well as the anti-environmental things that he did. And since then, in the United States at least, there's been a whole series of developments which I think have really put us on the wrong track, right? There was a minute, things were looking hopeful, right, where we were going. But in fact, I feel, here in the UK, I know you recently closed your last coal-powered power plant. And in the U.S., we are set to have record levels of fossil fuel production, right? With no end in sight, really, to where it's going. So I really wanted to do a deep dive into how and why did we get to this place? Why do we refuse to stop burning fossil fuels in the face of impending disaster? And part of me was curious about what was going on, and part of me was angry. And one of the ways, frankly, in which I deal with big feelings of anxiety and rage is I research them. That's a strategy to help like impose order on a chaotic world. And in this case, I really want to know like who is to blame. And there's many different actors that are to blame. It's not like there's just one. But I'm doing a deep dive into just one. I'm especially angry knowing that we have wasted precious decades that could have made a difference. According to the UN, we are on track for a 4.8 degree temperature increase by 2100. And here in the slide, the beige color shows you where current climate policies will take us, or current climate realities, I should say, and the blue is where we need to be to limit it to 2.7. And remember, that 2.7 itself was a compromise, right? That was a compromise that was decided upon and still will lead to vast levels of death and destruction. Well, emissions have been on a one-way trajectory, going up and up and up. Our efforts to address it have not been. They have been much more varied, I think. And I think that we have had periods of action, hope, failure, frustration, and what I argue right now, we're in a phase in the United States of overt obstruction in terms of climate action. And I think we need to document this journey in the path of where we're going. It's especially important, I think, because scientific consensus has existed since at least 2006. Moreover, we have known how to mitigate the problem. It's not a mystery. We have to stop burning fossil fuels. Thus, what we need to do, I think, is interrogate our failure to act. And of course, the U.S. looms very large in these scenarios. Besides being a global powerhouse, we're the largest historic emitter of greenhouse gases, and we are also the global leader when it comes to denial and obstruction. Of course, there are positive things happening as well. I don't want to pretend otherwise. There's a proliferation of renewable energy that's happening globally and in the United States. But this does not change the fact that emissions continue to climb. As I said, we're set to produce record levels of crude oil in the United States. And other countries that were also committed to cutbacks have also begun backsliding. Countries like Canada and Brazil. And their logic is that as long as there is market demand, we will meet it. So today, I want to focus on one dimension of climate obstruction, and that is the role of white nationalism. Now, we know a lot about how racism exacerbates the consequences of climate change, but we know much less about how racism is implicated in climate obstruction. Now, many scholars have documented the fossil fuel industry's disinformation campaigns, which have contributed to massive levels of denial as well as delay and obstruction. More recently, researchers have shifted their attention from denial to more aggressive forms of inaction. Scholars like Kari Norgaard and Kara Daggett have framed climate inaction as existing along a spectrum: ignorance, denial, enabling, refusal, and obstruction. I'm interested in this last phase. I define climate obstruction as intentional and systematic efforts to block actions that would mitigate the climate crisis. This includes things like supporting the fossil fuel industry, undermining alternatives, attacking advocates of climate action, as well as undermining educational efforts. My analysis centers on the U.S.'s Republican Party, also known as the GOP. Noam Chomsky has described the GOP as, quote, "the most dangerous organization on earth," unquote. Given its power and influence, including the fact, as I've already said, about the U.S. being the historic emitter and currently the world's largest producer of crude, he is not wrong. What the U.S. does has enormous implications for the global climate, as it seeks to block climate action in an unprecedented fashion. I began tracking the GOP when I began seeing some really baffling things. For example, North Carolina passed a law prohibiting public EV charging stations unless there were also public fossil fuel gas stations. They actually allocated money to destroy the public EV charging stations if they did not comply with this rule. At first, I assumed the state was just doing the bidding of the fossil fuel industry, what is often called regulatory capture. But as I looked at the data, I realized that there was more going on. With the help of different research assistants, including one here from the LSE, I began building a database of GOP obstruction. Although our data extends back to 2009, today I'm just going to discuss the war on wokeness, which I think offers a very powerful example of how white nationalism can be linked to climate obstruction. So what I'm going to do today is first, I'm going to explain why the GOP's actions are not merely a case of regulatory capture. Second, I discuss the evolution of the GOP's climate obstruction and try to answer the question, how did we get here? And lastly, I present some data on the war on wokeness and looking at that intersection. So in their book, Climate Obstruction, Ekberg, Frotner, Holtman, and Gila offer their conceptualization of climate obstruction, and they identify three types. First, there is primary obstruction, and this is basically just conventional denial. And while pockets of this still exist within the GOP, this no longer characterizes the party. Although, I will tell you just today, I don't know if any of you have been following the U.S. about the latest hurricane that we have there, Marjorie Graham Greene, a congresswoman from Georgia, now says that they, as in the state and the Democrats, are controlling the climate. And that is why Florida got the hurricane it got. Because we don't want them to vote next month. I don't know what you call that. Okay, and then we have secondary obstruction, all right? And secondary obstruction is when the science is accepted, but meaningful action is delayed for ideological, economic, or political reasons. I don't know if any of you were following the Republican Party primaries before Trump was elected as their candidate, but in their primaries, both Nikki Haley and Ron DeSantis exemplified this. They wanted to end tax subsidies for renewable energy because China was now the leading greenhouse gas emitter. According to their logic, until all countries reduce emissions, it makes no sense for the U.S. to do so. And then we have tertiary obstruction. This focuses on how cultures, hierarchies, values, and infrastructure lead to obstructions. The authors focus primarily on non-intentional obstruction, but that is not the case with the GOP, which is a very important distinction. Nevertheless, I very much like the way they've laid out the elements of obstruction, and I want to build on their work. I argue that white supremacy is a cultural element that contributes to obstruction. Moreover, the political process is a form of infrastructure that is being employed to obstruct climate action in very specific ways. This requires that we understand the nexus of the state, culture, and industry. Andreas Malm and the Zetkin Collective argue that the fossil fuel industry's denial machine should be understood as an ideological state apparatus, or what they call an ISA. And they define an ISA as a system of defined institutions, organizations, and the corresponding practices, which through their day-to-day activities, uphold some elements of the dominant ideology. In this case, the dominant ideology is that fossil fuel use is good. Moreover, they point out that this belief is rooted in a particular mode of accumulation, what they call fossil capital. Fossil capital is facing an existential crisis, and the state, as part of the fossil fuel ISA, has sought to bolster it. Of course, both political parties in the United States, the Democrats and the Republicans, are implicated in the fossil fuel ISA. But the two parties are not the same, at least not anymore. Democrats have a record of attempting climate action, however limited. Since the Kyoto Protocol, capitalist climate governance has been the norm. Capitalist climate governance is not denial, but strategies that postpone meaningful action while creating new opportunities for capital. The GOP once supported capitalist climate governance as it aligns with free markets and new industries, which the GOP used to rally around. But these are no longer Republican priorities. This is one reason why I don't think its actions are just a case of regulatory capture. Of course, there is no doubt that the GOP is following the money. I don't want to suggest otherwise. In fact, 80% of all fossil fuel money goes to Republicans. And here we can see the politicians in orange. These are showing their donations from fossil fuel industry, and the ones in blue are the Democrats. There's just two Democrats, both from Texas. But I don't think, again, the fossil fuel money is the whole story. And I feel there's, in particular, there's four shortcomings with this narrative. First, the GOP has not always aligned with the fossil fuel industry in the way that it does today. Second, the GOP's climate obstruction does not reflect its voters' desires. Third, this overlooks the role of race and assumes a non-racial state. And lastly, this ignores the larger cultural meanings embedded in climate change. And I'll go through each of these briefly in turn. First, capital is nothing if not practical. It knows the future and is planning for energy alternatives and maintaining fossil fuel production. From a capitalist perspective, this makes perfect sense. For example, in 2021, the American Petroleum Institute identified actions to combat climate change, including putting a price on carbon. Shell and BP are getting into renewables, and ExxonMobil is drilling its first lithium well in Arkansas as we speak. Now, I don't want to greenwash the fossil fuel industry, far be it from that, but it contrasts with the GOP, who literally opposes everything. And recall, the GOP has not always been this way. The Bush administration, working with the fossil fuel industry's Global Climate Coalition, left the Kyoto Protocol in 2001. Instead, it introduced the Clear Skies Initiative, a much weaker plan based on voluntary cutbacks and tax credits. Here, the GOP is bowing to industry, but realizes the need for some kind of action. Today, this would be unthinkable for the GOP. Two, the GOP's climate obstruction does not reflect the desires of its base, especially its younger voters. Research indicates that large majorities of Americans believe climate change is real. Now, admittedly, it has taken us a very long time to get here, but we finally did. And I want to bring your attention here to the red. These are the Republican voters. And you can see, again, over 50% of them. Actually, right now, 94% of Democrats and 67% of Republicans believe in climate change as real. Moreover, over 60% of Republicans believe the government should take some action. Again, let's focus on the red here, right, that we see the Republican respondents. Now, there's great disagreement on many issues around this. Again, I don't want to pretend otherwise. But I do argue that the GOP's actions do not reflect its base. Its base is not clamoring for climate obstruction. Instead, what we have is a situation where the GOP is trying to sell climate obstruction to its base in various kinds of ways. The third reason we need to look beyond regulatory capture is that it assumes a non-racial state. If the fossil fuel ISA exists at the intersection of the state and civil society, and if race is a material discursive formation embedded in U.S. history, territory, and culture, it presumably plays a role in many topics seemingly unrelated to race. Heather McGee, in her wonderful book, The Sum of Us, shows how racism costs all Americans and is responsible for such things as the absence of a universal health care system in the country. She argues that because whites worry black people would disproportionately benefit from universal health care, they opposed it altogether. And I think her work is really very important because it shows the unanticipated consequences of racism. In another case she talks about in her book, which is fairly well known if you know of U.S. history, in the state of Virginia, when they were forced to integrate, some schools refused to do it, and so they just shut down the schools. Kids did not get educated for a while, right? Because that's the consequences of racism, right? In this way, in thinking about education and thinking about healthcare, we can see its surplus nature and how racism spills out onto issues seemingly unrelated to race, and particularly the way they affect white people as well. The final problem stemming from a regulatory capture framework is that it overlooks the many meanings embedded in fossil fuels. Naomi Klein has argued that the right understands the profound challenges that climate change poses to its worldview and values. She argues that climate change is, in fact, an indictment of capitalism. It poses a crisis not just to our physical world, but to the right's ideology. Thus, the GOP's commitment to obstruction is an attempt to deny an existential threat. Some of you may recall the light bulb hullabaloo in the US several years ago. In this instance, the US tried to shift from incandescent to LED light bulbs for energy efficiency. The GOP led a campaign against it, equating light bulbs with freedom. The ISA framework helps us understand how various meanings can be attached to fossil fuels so that light bulbs become equated with personal freedom. Recall that it is a system of institutions, organizations, and practices which uphold dominant ideologies. Drawing again on Malm and the Zetkin Collective, three features of the fossil fuel in ISA are especially relevant to my analysis. First, as previously mentioned, ISAs operate at the interface of civil society and the state. This allows for many different kinds of connections, again, particularly by linking white supremacy and the state. Second, the far right and the fossil fuel ISA are intimately connected. And they, in their book, which you may be familiar with, go through lots of different examples how this is happening, especially in Europe. And lastly, white nationalism is a central feature of the US right. It probably is a feature of most rights, you know, but I talk specifically about the United States. White nationalism is kind of like the mitochondria of the GOP. It generates endless energy that can be used and harnessed for all kinds of purposes. Drawing on Benedict Anderson and Sunira Thubani, I define the white nation as an imagined sovereign political community in which white people and whiteness are centered. It's important to point out that anybody can be part of the white nation, right? You can be black, indigenous, whatever. You just have to have those values, right, and be willing and wanting to center whiteness. Because whiteness is a hierarchical, genocidal, and exclusionary category, its legitimacy requires the erasure of its violence. This entails the cultivation and maintenance of white innocence. The problem for the white nation is that it is facing multiple crises. Not only are the demographics of the US changing, what they call the Great Replacement, but the very innocence of the white nation is being questioned in an unprecedented fashion. We can see this in Black Lives Matter movement, as well as calls for racial and colonial reckoning. Thus, the right is contending with two existential crises. And I'm going to focus here in this overlapping section. This is where white nationalism becomes linked to climate obstruction. White nationalism has been key to the GOP's success for decades. Starting with the advent of the Southern Strategy in the early 1970s, which was when the GOP decided to forsake black voters and other voters of color and decided to tie their fate to white Southerners. This allowed them to make overt appeals to white supremacy. The GOP learned that actively cultivating white grievance and resentment works. As you likely know, the current GOP relies heavily on white nationalism to attract supporters and get out the votes. In this first slide here, this is from Trump's 2015 presidential campaign. This is how he announced his presidential campaign, coming down the golden stairs of one of his Trump properties, right? Announcing that Mexico is not sending its people. They're not sending, Mexico is sending its people. They're not sending their best. They're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists. And some, I assume, are good people. And here we have, this is like from a month ago, over in Trump and J.D. Vance, his vice presidential campaign, are obsessed with the fact or the idea that black Haitian immigrants in Ohio are eating their pets, right? And this is really, of course, a way of dehumanizing them. It's a way of appealing to the white nation. These are like really appeals like we got to get rid of these people, right? They're eating our pets, right? As such, white nationalism produces value for the right through votes, political energy, and for the larger fossil fuel industry as well. Now, although the GOP once engaged in capitalist climate governance, that changed as it shifted further to the right and the U.S. became more polarized. How did we get here? There are many potential starting points. I choose to focus on Newt Gingrich, which some of you may or may not recall. He was a congressional leader and Speaker of the House of Representatives in the late 1990s. Now, Gingrich is important for many reasons. Besides his contract with America, which is really a neoliberal roadmap for the United States, he was a key player in shifting the political culture of the US. He did so by doing such things as impeaching Bill Clinton, imposing government shutdowns, and leading the GOP to retake the House of Representatives, ending 40 years of Democratic control. While this may not seem noteworthy in today's political culture, Gingrich was a bellwether for what was to come. His goal was, quote, to build a much more aggressive activist party. And that he did. Party dynamics are essential to understanding climate obstruction, especially polarization. Political polarization both relies on and produces a set of values, ideologies, and actions that are ascribed to each side. Linking climate change to a particular set of values facilitates a politics of obstruction. We saw this first with the Tea Party, which emerged in 2009 in the wake of the fiscal crisis. It unleashed a torrent of white rage that swept 138 new Republicans into Congress. Building on Gingrich, the Tea Party ushered in a new political landscape centered on non-cooperation and polarization. Reversing previous trends, it contributed actually to an uptick in climate denial. An energized GOP went on the attack, including Senator Jim Inhofe from Oklahoma, who argued against the existence of a scientific consensus in response to the leaked emails of the Climate Research Unit at East Anglia University in 2009, which some of you may recall. The Tea Party declined with Trump's first presidential campaign, as it essentially morphed into MAGA, or Make America Great Again. During the Trump era, we see a major increase in climate obstruction. Besides leaving the Paris Climate Accord, 112 Obama-era environmental regulations were overturned, including the Clean Power Plan, which was the US first attempt to shift our power structure away from fossil fuels. This slide here just shows one estimate of the emissions generated from the rollbacks. This was produced from the Rhodium Group, and here on the far right here, you see this is measured in million metric tons of CO2 equivalent of what was generated from the rollbacks. And I think this was really important to remind people about the very real and material consequences of these actions. These are not just abstract things that we are talking about. Trump was also a master of linking climate to other meanings and cultural formations. The war on coal provides one example of how the fossil fuel ISA operates and how climate obstruction became embedded in polarization. The war on coal was what Trump called the Obama administration's climate action policies. Trump declared the war over in March 2017 when he passed an executive order revoking the rules on carbon emissions. But the war on coal was not just about carbon emissions. It performed significant political and ideological work. The war on coal was a discursive strategy that flipped what was becoming normative thinking regarding carbon emissions, i.e., we need to limit them. Instead, it celebrated coal with promises to restore the industry. Obviously, that didn't happen, as market forces, especially natural gas, have reduced the viability of coal. Nonetheless, the celebration of coal paved the way for redeeming the larger fossil fuel industry, which is bearing fruit today. Equally important, the war on coal was a way to connect with coal miners, 90% of whom are white and 93% of whom are men. As such, they represent a key demographic, rural, white, male, working class voters. Trump used coal to portray himself as a friend of workers, successfully linking together struggling whites, anti-elitism, and the fossil fuel industry. In this way, Trump positioned a relatively sympathetic population as anti-climate, and anyone who did not support the coal support coal were considered antagonistic to rural communities. This is political polarization in action. Let us now turn to the war on wokeness. The war on wokeness represents a new level and form of climate obstruction. It explicitly links climate action to the culture wars, especially white nationalism. Wokeness is the right's caricature of left politics. Though it ridicules identity politics, pronouns, and anti-racism, it is really a rejection of anti-racist and non-conforming gender politics. Although its roots go back to the 1970s, it matured in response to the anti-racist movement that developed after the murder of George Floyd in 2020. As you may recall, there was massive public support for Black Lives Matter across the US and even across the globe. Kimberly Crenshaw argued that the war on wokeness is the backlash to the insistence that Black lives actually do matter, as well as calls for a racial and colonial reckoning. Throughout US history, all forms of racial progress have been followed by a white backlash dating back to Reconstruction. And Reconstruction is a point right after the Civil War when there were attempts to bolster Black communities and provide some levels of reparation. The current backlash began with critiques of police as racist. The right responded by defending police and developing Blue Lives Matter, which has become its own kind of movement. They especially rejected claims that the police were racist. This is important because white innocence was being directly challenged by anti-racist activists. So the white nation mobilized. While this is happening culturally, there were also many changes happening in the arena of electoral politics. It is a conjuncture of these two spheres which leads to the war on wokeness. After the Trump presidency, two important things happen. First, Biden gets elected, and we see some actual progress on climate. Specifically, the Inflation Reduction Act was passed in 2022. This was the US most significant climate legislation to date. Second, the fight for the soul of the Republican Party begins. It may be hard to believe this now, but many in the GOP came to believe that Trump was a liability, given his impeachment and role in the January 6th insurrection. Accordingly, many Republicans wanted a change in leadership. However, Trump still controlled the base, MAGA. The political dynamics surrounding the battle for control of the GOP are key to this story. GOP candidates began competing with each other, trying to win over the MAGA base. To do this, they competed to stake out the most right-wing positions possible. This went on until January 2024, when Ron DeSantis dropped out of the Republican primary. If one of these politicians could have attracted MAGA support, the GOP could have nominated somebody other than Trump. Of course, no politician succeeded. Consequently, wokeness became central to the GOP primary. Both Vivek Ramaswamy, who is portrayed here, and Ron DeSantis made it a centerpiece of their campaigns. Ron DeSantis declared that his state, Florida, was, quote, where wokeness goes to die, unquote. And Ramaswamy wrote a whole book attacking corporate wokeness. He comes from the corporate sector. The war on wokeness essentially divides the US into those who believe that white supremacy is a central part of US history and culture, and those who not only reject this belief, but insist that whites are threatened by discrimination, demographic replacement, and the decentering of whiteness. And we actually, I should have brought some of this data. We do have survey data on white people in the United States over the last couple of years, and they actually do believe that they face more discrimination than, for example, black people in the United States. You know, it's a very sincere belief. The war on wokeness started with critical race theory, and it was a brainchild of this guy, Chris Rufo. He's a conservative commentator who created a moral panic by distorting an academic field of study into a white racial grievance. According to Rufo, quote, the goal is to have the public read something crazy in the newspaper and immediately think critical race theory, unquote. It has been enormously successful. The war on wokeness has created energy that the right has harnessed for multiple purposes. Children are key to the war on wokeness. Opponents of critical race theory claimed it was used to indoctrinate students and led some, i.e. white students, to feel discomfort when discussing the racial past. Accordingly, the GOP began limiting what teachers could say about race in K-12 education. Soon, statewide laws placed limits on discussions of race. Between September 2020 and April 2024, 807 bills, executive orders, and measures were introduced. The bills vary in their scope, ambiguity, and provisions. Some require that teachers tell both sides of racial issues, while others require that no one is made to feel discomfort when discussing the racial past. In North Dakota, teachers are prohibited from presenting racism as anything other than individual biases. In other words, structural racism does not exist. As of June 2024, there were only six states where anti-CRT legislation had not been introduced. Attacks on CRT quickly spread to diversity, equity, and inclusion, or DEI initiatives. While CRT can be understood as a set of ideas, DEI is about praxis. How do we create more diverse and inclusive environments? Opposition to DEI began at schools, but spread to other institutions, including corporations. Here, we can see where anti-DEI legislation has been introduced in higher education. And you may recall this past winter when Republicans held hearings on US universities. Anti-DEI sentiment was instrumental in the removal of two university presidents, including the president of Harvard University. The war on wokeness then moved into gender and sexuality. Florida's infamous Don't Say Gay bill signaled the new terrain. Passed in March 2023, it banned classroom discussions of gender identity or sexual orientation in primary schools. This was followed by HB 1069, which banned the use of pronouns consistent with a student's gender identity and enhanced the book banning process. This ferocious energy around anti-racism, gender equality, and the right to be queer and trans is a winning strategy for the right. However, the GOP also understands that public opinion is not on its side when it comes to climate. as we've seen solid majorities, including Republicans, believe climate change is real and support some kind of action, however modest. Because the GOP's position on climate is not popular, it needs other ways to frame it. Enter the war on wokeness. Climate obstruction builds on the war on wokeness in several ways. First, it clearly locates climate in the culture wars and is part of the woke fiefdom, as some politicians call it. Second, it borrows strategies and language, especially that of bannings and restrictions. Third, similar to the right's denial of structural racism, the war on wokeness resists linking climate to structural issues. Particularly, I will be talking about finance capital. And fourth, it insists that the real existential threat is wokeness, not climate. So I'm just going to talk briefly about some of the barring strategies and then move on to ESG and finance capital. Now, the heart of the war on wokeness is restricting what can be said and read through banning. Although not widely supported by the general public, MAGA has embraced it. Bannings are highly visible events that solidify politicians' conservative credentials and forge relationships with conservative activists. Many of the local book bannings are spearheaded by groups like Moms for Liberty, who work closely with Republican politicians. And here we can see the geography of book bannings. And basically, the darker the color, that's where there has been the highest levels of book banning that have in the United States. And you can see clearly a pattern of greater concentration, particularly in some of the southern states. This same tactic has been used to support climate obstruction. For example, Florida's H.R. 1645 bans the word climate change from state laws and shifts policy priorities to energy dominance. That's your new framework. In Texas, a bill was introduced that will block eighth graders from learning about climate. In Ohio, a bill was introduced that explicitly linked climate to higher education's woke fiefdom. It sought to ban diversity training while requiring alternative theories on climate, immigration, and abortion. Although it failed, it illustrates how climate has been fully incorporated into the war on wokeness. In Arizona, Republicans passed a law that would ban the use of public funding for any Marxist ideology. That's the words in the law. Needless to say, this includes climate action. Now, under this law, anybody can actually sue if they see public funds being used to promote these Marxist ideologies. Talk about vague. And this is so ironic to juxtapose it with the previous kind of priorities of the Republican Party, which used to center on individual rights, personal freedom, and liberty, these kinds of things like that. And now we're just seeing this huge kind of curtailment by the state itself, right? So it's deeply ironic what is happening here. I want to now shift gears to finance, capital, and ESG. So ESG stands for Environmental Social Governance. And this is an investing practice that requires the disclosure of environmental and social concerns. It emerged approximately 20 years ago to ensure the long-term viability of investments, but was also used to encourage corporate accountability regarding coerced labor, working conditions, sexual harassment, racial bias, and environmental impacts. Climate change became part of ESG because many investors felt that such information was required to fully assess the risk associated with an investment. Will the building I want to buy be underwater in 20 years? Not surprisingly, insurance companies have led the way in insisting that climate change be considered. But because climate has become part of woke capitalism, it has drawn the ire of the GOP. Now, woke capitalism rests on two powerful ideas. First, it is a clear move to undermine certain industries linked to the reviled woke agenda. And second, it's meant to demonstrate the reach and power of liberal culture. i.e. the libs have even infiltrated investment. As one commentator explained, ESG is a direct assault on the heart and soul of the free market economy, unquote. This is important because it creates an enemy for the GOP to wage war against, which is what a party of grievance always requires, an enemy. So you always need to be cultivating them, right? GOP opposition to ESG began in 2020. And here's just the beginnings of a selected timeline that we have developed. According to a New York Times investigation, ESG became a target when some oil and gas companies complained of hostility and declining investment. They felt they were being discriminated against. And they probably were, as growing numbers of institutions were divesting from fossil fuels. In response, the State Financial Officers Federation, or the SFOF, an historically bipartisan organization, went on the offensive. This is a little-known organization that has been weaponized by the right. The SFOF has two goals when it comes to ESG: to encourage state laws that restrict firms employing ESG criteria, and second, blocking federal appointees and nominees who support climate risk disclosure or who have been critical of the fossil fuel industry. In 2023 alone, 165 bills and resolutions were introduced across 37 states to limit ESG. Texas was the first to pass legislation restricting state agencies' engagement with firms who boycott, as they say, fossil fuels. Laws soon followed in West Virginia, Texas, Oklahoma, Florida, and other states. In November 2021, a group of red states began developing laws modeled after Texas. And these state laws vary considerably. Florida's HB 33 limits government agencies at all levels from considering ESG, whereas West Virginia's SB 262 creates a list of suspect firms and places them on a restricted list. Placing names on a restricted list not only precludes firms from doing business in the state, but the announcements themselves have become media events. According to State Treasurer Riley Moore, quote, "If a bank has a no lending policy as relates to thermal coal, we'll find a bank that doesn't have that policy," unquote. In March 2023, 18 states formed an alliance to, quote, "protect individuals from the ESG movement," unquote. Now, much of this activity has been at the state level, but red states, led by the SFOF, have also challenged federal ESG rules. As mentioned earlier, ESG began in 2004 and gained traction among corporations. The next step was to codify ESG in investing law and practices. The European Union adopted standards in 2003, as did the International Sustainability Standards Board. From a capitalist point of view, having a shared set of standards is desirable. According to the US's Securities and Exchange Commission, or SEC, which oversees all investing, pursued a similar path. In 2022, the SEC introduced a provision to enhance and standardize climate-related disclosures for investors. This was an effort to do just that, enhance and standardize climate disclosures. To facilitate the process, the SEC developed three levels known as Scopes 1, 2, and 3. While Scopes 1 and 2 focus on individual firms themselves, Scope 3 required firms to disclose greenhouse gas emissions up and down the supply chain, right? So for fossil fuel companies, this would have meant calculating and publicizing the emissions associated with the transportation sector, which of course would have been massive. A Republican uproar ensued. The SFOF, opposing the provision, wrote, "The proposed rule indulges in irrational climate exceptionalism, elevating climate issues to a place of prominence in disclosures that they do not deserve. The proposed rule is also about forcing issuers to take actions in compliance with a political agenda." Here, the SFOF is not only rejecting climate concerns, but is forcefully countering climate activist influence, which they have been, you know, very influential in pushing for these provisions. The final rule did pass without Scope 3, although that is being challenged in court. Central to the SFOF's argument is the idea that climate disclosures are antitrust, as firms are supposedly colluding to boycott fossil fuels. Although few think this will stand up in court, this campaign is having real-world consequences, as U.S. firms are increasingly shying away from assessing climate risk. Numerous firms have left Climate Action 100+. And this is a global group of investors who seek to use their money to push corporations to reduce emissions. While European firms are joining Climate Action 100, U.S. firms are leaving, including major ones like J.P. Morgan, BlackRock, and Goldman Sachs. The GOP has also opposed federal appointees who embrace ESG or are otherwise critical of the fossil fuel industry. In 2021, Saule Omowara was nominated for the position of U.S. Comptroller of Currency. She had previously been critical of the fossil fuel industry. In November, the SFOF opposed her nomination, and in December, she was forced to withdraw her candidacy. A larger debacle ensued around Sarah Raskin Bloom, who was nominated by President Biden as vice chair of the Federal Reserve, which is kind of like the U.S.'s central bank. She had argued that responsible investing required full transparency regarding climate. In February 2022, she was opposed by the SFOF, and in March, Biden withdrew her name. As I've said, the GOP sees the war on wokeness and ESG as a winning set of issues. Representative Banks of Indiana claimed that wokeness is, quote, the greatest domestic threat to American society, unquote. And Patrick McHenry of North Carolina has created the Republican ESG Working Group. It is important to realize that many red states like West Virginia, Texas, Oklahoma, and Utah are closely tied to the fossil fuel industry. They argue that fossil fuel provide good jobs and that ESG is an attack on affordable energy. And it is true that if the fossil fuel industry is diminished, their state coffers will suffer, at least initially. Nonetheless, the GOP is clearly privileging fossil fuels over other industries and interests. Research indicates that anti-ESG laws actually cost states money by using firms which may be less competitive but align with GOP values. In Texas, both individuals and state officials have sued over anti-ESG laws, arguing that they prohibit the state from fulfilling its obligations. It is deeply ironic that the GOP is so clearly favoring one industry over others, given its historic complaint that Democrats are the ones who pick winners and losers in the energy sector. So to conclude, at this historical moment, the alliance between the fossil fuel industry and the GOP is producing value for each other in exceptional ways. The fossil fuel industry provides a platform for the GOP to attack ESG and woke culture in general, while solidifying its identity as the anti-woke party. The fossil fuel industry benefits by extending the life of extraction and reaping extraordinary profits. As recently as 2020, the fossil fuel industry was facing a series of diminished possibilities. For the fossil fuel industry, the GOP's war on wokeness is an unimaginable gift. Who could have imagined that climate action would be negatively linked to racial justice? It's important to stress that there are multiple ways in which white nationalism is implicated in climate obstruction. I have just teased out one strand. Is the juxtaposition of mass deportations and increased oil extraction coincidental? I think not. Although there's a long history of racial backlash, the latest episode is a direct response to Black Lives Matter. Here we see the excess nature of and unanticipated consequences of white nationalism. The white backlash has generated enormous energy that the GOP has been able to direct in unanticipated ways, including climate and wokeness. Never can we underestimate the power of the white nation to maintain its privileged place in society with negative consequences for the entire planet. Thank you.
Well, this was a wonderful way of opening the department's new lecture series, which is the Sustainability Public Lecture Series. So a lot of thanks to Professor Laura Pulido for making this very insightful lecture to be the start of the lecture series that we are launching. It will be the time for an opening, inviting questions from the audience. I wouldn't try to summarize everything Laura has said, but I think Laura really gave us a chance to think about how these the opportunities to make very decisive decisions or measures were being obstructed by a system of deniers, which may include racial denier and climate denier, which are building upon this white nationalism that is very much central to the operation of the GOP machine. So with that in mind, I guess there will be some questions from the audience, and we'll try to choose for maybe two or three at the same time for Laura to respond. So please do raise your hand when you ask the question. Please do ask a question, not a statement. And also, please try, if possible, try to include your name and brief background so that we know who you are. So thank you very much. So we have one in the middle. I think
there's one over here, the one in hand, and another at the other side of the room.
Yes, hello, my name is Merle. I study environmental policy and regulation here. And my question is, as you mentioned, fossil fuel extraction has been the highest ever under Biden as well, and I'm just wondering if that will change if Harris wins the election.
Oh, I don't think so. No. We have really seen a shift in the Democratic Party since, thank you for asking that question. We've really seen a shift in the Democratic Party in what they're saying because of the way the Republican Party has moved on climate and the demonization of climate. Having said that, I think the Democratic Party will probably continue to do their seesawing, hemming and hawing, moving forward with some things, absolutely. But also, she said, I'm okay with fracking now, and I see that's where the public is at. So I assume it's going to continue. Yeah.
There was one at that end, yes.
Hi, thank you so much for that. I was just going to ask if you'd thought at all about, and what your thoughts were, if any, about the aspect of religion in all of this. Religion.
Uh-huh.
And the connections there, whether it's to do with climate change denial as a kind of religious stance, or, for example, some of the letters from state governors where they've talked about fiduciary duty as almost written in the Bible or a religious duty that they have. And so ESG investing kind of working against that, how that plays into the whole white nationalist thing.
So studying the right, I have to study religion. Christianity in particular, evangelical Christians. And so they're actually really very interesting. The point you raise, the ideas about Christians, taking from the Bible, what we have seen, I think, is we have slowly shifted in the United States. So, again, most people believe that climate change is going on. I don't think that's, I do believe that. That's a real thing. What we do see, though, is because the U.S. is so polarized and because the Christian community is so 100% in the GOP camp, it's not 100%, 99%, something like that, that they end up supporting those positions, okay? And in many ways, actually, there are segments of the Christian community, so they're not all Christians, but there are segments they actually do believe that Donald Trump is divinely inspired, He is part of a prophecy. This is part of an attempt for the dominion of like the seven mountains that Christianity identified, which is essential for creating God's kingdom here on earth. So it's deep. It's very, very deep, you know. But again, most of it has to do with Trump and convincing them that I'm your man, you know. Yeah.
There's one there, and there may be one here, yes.
Hello. I'm Michael, also studying EPR, and I'm a climate activist also. I was, first, thank you for the great presentation. I was recently in the US, and we also talked to a couple of Republicans, but I did not know it was that bad.
It's bad.
Yeah. Looking back, do you think there's any point in history where the Democrats and civil society could have prevented that? And now, looking at like the present, do you think that there are any stakeholder groups within the GOP? Any stakeholder groups within the GOP who can be mobilized to stop that mess? And are there plans by the well-organized think tanks and pro-climate action organizations in the US to counteract?
So I should mention that there's this guy, I think his name is John Curtis, is his first name. He is a senator from Utah, and he is concerned about climate. And he started creating, he called it the Conservative Climate Caucus. At first they had me hiding, all right, because they knew they would be attacked by their fellow Republicans. They are now out in the open. There's about, I don't know, quite a number of members. But all they do is they say is educate, and they do not introduce legislation, and all of them literally voted Biden passed the Inflation Reduction Act, they voted to take it away, right? They are opposed to any kind of even tax credits for EV vehicles, I mean, the most modest of measures. So they have no action, they're not doing anything that would lead you to believe they actually care about the climate. But that could be a vehicle that could be harnessed in a particular direction. That is a possibility. Could the Democrats have done anything? Well, oh my God, they're just like so late. I mean, you know, the right is so organized in the United States, and that's one of the reasons why I've been studying the right, one of the reasons I talk about the right. We need to understand its power, its level of organization, and its capacity. I mean, Chris Rufo said, like, I'm gonna take this crazy idea, and he created this whole to-do about CRT. I mean, that's amazing. That's like real power, right, that are going on. And the Democrats have not been able to come up, I don't think, with any kind of compelling counter-narratives that really, that resonate with people. And so, no, they've done a terrible job. I mean, theoretically, I guess they could have done something other, but they have not shown that to date.
There's one question in the first row,
yeah.
And then maybe second question from the third row.
Hi, my name is Mikey. I'm studying conflict studies and comparative politics at LSE. My question is sort of a follow-up to that, which is, how much of this do you think stops and ends with Trump? So that's sort of two-part. One is, like, how much of the sort of climate denialism and the mess that we're in is strictly MAGA or strictly a Trump sort of thing? And then alternately, if we can hopefully think of a future post-Trump, is there a chance that strictly like thinking electorally with the amount of support within the GOP already, like within the GOP voters for some sort of modest climate policy, do you see a future in which we get there? If so, what does that look like?
So I want to be careful about Trump. You know, he is obviously enormously influential and powerful. And if Trump were to say tomorrow, yes, everyone, let's go get EVs, you know, his base would probably go buy EVs, you know. He went on an anti-EV tirade earlier when he was mad at Elon Musk earlier this year. He hates EVs, EVs are the worst, and now he's like changed his mind because Elon Musk is supporting him, right? So, you know, Mr. Principal. I think this goes beyond Trump. I have to believe that it goes beyond Trump. You know, I think the GOP has, since the Southern Strategy, you know, the GOP is all about, they don't have numbers on their side historically because their policies are not popular. So they have to come up with different kinds of like campaigns and enemies and things like this to support them. And I don't see that changing. And there's actually very real material benefits to be had in Republican-dominated states from the fossil industries. Why would they want to give that up? Well, okay, you can look at Florida, two huge hurricanes in a row. You know, that might be one argument, but so far, does not seem to be compelling. So, no, I'm not very hopeful, and I don't think it's going to change, even if Trump is not elected. Yeah.
We have a third row here. One question, maybe one from the back.
Hi, I'm Bianca. I study environment and development here. And my question is kind of twofold. In my previous job, we worked a lot with IRA companies, with the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act, and like private sector companies. And we saw it as kind of like an incentive or like a way that they were trying to fix the incentive structure to make people, I guess, companies participate more in climate action. So my question is how you saw that process and like the development of the IRA within this phenomena and like the role of the private sector now, because for a while they were kind of standing their ground and like you see a few companies like go against DeSantis in Florida, but we also saw a lot of them pulling back in environmental commitments and sustainability. So I was wondering how that dynamic.
So I have no comment about the IRA process. I have no idea how that was unfolding. But the point about the private sector is really interesting and important to the story, because especially in Texas, of all states, and this is like, you know, one of the most leading the anti-ESG charge, all opposed to climate action, they generate more renewable energy than any other state, right? Part of it has to do with this geography and the different resources they have in terms of sunlight, wind, and things like that. But, and Florida, too, actually, has a significant level of renewable energy because the private sector has gone in there and they've been allowed to do this work. So it's a great contradiction that is happening. And right, I know there's like there's supposed to be an EV car station being built in North Carolina. There's a lot of infrastructure happening and development happening in Georgia, right? And so I know, again, the Democrats have done a really bad job like trying to sell it. Actually, we're producing these manufacturing jobs here, you know, that are related to climate, and they have been enormously ineffective at doing so. So, you know, there are two stories happening in the United States, right? The private sector one, and then what's happening in the legislative arena.
I think in the middle with the orange sweater, and another at the very far back, and with green jacket.
Hi, my name is Elena. My background is in geography, and I work in the field of human rights at the moment. My question is around the extreme climate events that we're seeing at the moment in the U.S. that you mentioned earlier, and I'm just curious as to how the GOP is talking about these events without necessarily linking it to climate change, given how like obvious and extreme these events are becoming, and whether you believe that the fact that they're taking place so close to the election is having any sway perhaps on either party or the voter base in these like key states.
Mm-hmm. Right. No. So I get this question a lot, you know, like, because we have these climate catastrophes happening of various sorts, like, cannot people see the writing on the wall or do not make that connection? And there's a couple of things that are happening. I mean, this really started in with Sandy, which I believe is in 2012, and that was such a key event. This was a huge, you know, event that happened, like, in New York, and people are going to see it now. This is like a new day that people will be aware of it. You know, and that lasted for a short period of time. But what we have now, we actively, I think, have a whole media ecosystem which is very carefully and deliberately not making the connection between what is happening and climate change, right? And because the U.S. is so polarized, you know, we get our news sources from completely different places. And so Fox News, Tucker Carlson, they're not talking about the connection with climate change and these hurricanes. You know, on the other hand, I think this is maybe the first time I've heard this. I don't know if it was on the BBC or NPR. There was talking about the last week's hurricane, I think Helena, as well as this current one. And they were actually documenting now, like, we know that this temperature, you know, contributed to 10 extra inches of rainfall or whatever. So they were making very precise kind of connections, which previously I don't think scientists have been able or willing to make those kinds of connections, right? And so I think this is a new and hopeful thing that I think will help. But, you know, if you're not hearing those connections, right, I don't know that everybody even knows, you know, unless you are really paying attention or you've gone to school, that you know that, you know, intensified hurricanes are a consequence of climate change. What people do know what is a consequence of climate change is heat. That is very real, that people understand it is getting hotter, you know, and they're aware of that. But the hurricane ones, you know, I think not so much.
Hi, Inam, PhD student at the Geography and Environment Department. I think it was very strategic promoting the event in Xtwitter, given its white nationalist takeover. They should hear it. But talking about Elon Musk being like mingling with Trump and all, and he is a believer in terraforming, geoengineering, solar radiation management, all of those technocentric approaches to climate change. And in future, I want to know how you see it pan out, like if we see like the way they have a consensus across the table on genocide denial, if like climate denial becomes something that they agree with, like either like they stop denying climate change but go to technocentric approaches which favors the industries, or both of them starts denying climate. Like I want to see know your opinion about the future. Like when Trump becomes a past, but we have Elon Musk, the future trillionaire, influencing the new leadership of both parties.
So I think the U.S. will, it is embarking on a variety of different kind of like major technological solutions or strategies, right? I know they're building caverns that are gonna suck in CO2. We have Elon Musk's ideas, and I think we're gonna continue doing those things. And I think, because those are things that we can, they're politically palatable, right? They don't require any change in our social or economic systems. There's new opportunities for capital in them. So I think that they will continue to happen, you know? And I can even imagine Trump supporting things like that as well, you know? Big, bold, kind of, you know, flashy projects like that. You know, I can imagine today too. I mean, Trump will say whatever convenient for him, right? So it's sometimes it's like climate denial, it's not change, it's not really real. But other times you can imagine, oh yes, it's really happening, but we got a problem. It's all we got it fixed. We know what we're doing, you know, with his technological solutions. So I don't believe that the Democrats will ever embrace climate denialism. I mean, there's strong sentiment in the United States, especially from young people, like, no, this is a crisis, we need to act upon it. And I think they will continue to try to put solutions forward in piecemeal, you know, kind of moving along fashion. I think we'll continue to do those things. Although if Trump is president, you know, all bets are off for the next
one. I think we should probably have time for about two more questions. So yes, one over there, both from the right, and another over there.
Hi, my name is Marguerite. I'm doing my master's in environmental policy, also from the US, unfortunately, it seems. My question is, you've painted a really clear picture on kind of the rise of white nationalism in the US and the Tea Party movement and all of the kind of previous movements on the right that led to our current moment. I'm curious if you've looked at any other countries. I mean, we've seen the rise of right-wing extremism in a lot of other European countries and other places around the world. If you've seen any similar patterns when it comes to climate denialism, or if you think this is a uniquely American problem.
Right. I haven't systematically studied other countries, but I have read definitely certain other countries. And there is definitely a group of scholars, particularly focused on European countries, and looking at the rise of the right and their relationship to climate and general environmental issues. And what they more often frame their what's happening there is ecofascism. And when certain kinds of environmental issues and concerns become relevant to protect the nation, but it's not what's happening in the United States. I mean, the United States is an outlier in that way, this overt level of obstruction. So it's somewhat different dynamic, I think.
Hi. I am an exchange student, but I'm staying here at LSE for the year. And thank you so much for your presentation, for your research. And you mentioned that there is kind of a growing acknowledgement that climate change is an issue, et cetera, even in the US. And so I'm wondering whether or what your opinion is on the link between academic institutions, research institutions that are working on this, you know, information and researching more about these issues and policies, and how maybe that could influence, and counter what we're seeing or not. Thank you.
So there is a whole lot of work being done in the United States between, you know, higher ed and, you know, particularly at the state level as well. Most of them, I would say, they focus on things about like how to make communities more resilient, right? That often used word. How to make them more resilient, or developing other kinds of schemes. They're not focused at all on how do we deal with denial. We're not focused on the right. They're not focused at all on how do you deal with overt levels of obstruction. So I kind of feel like we're not studying the right thing.
Any burning question before we... I think you had a chance at that. or maybe just one more here, yes.
Hi, I'm also from the Environment Policy and Regulation Program. What would you like us to do as students and as people who will try to do better as an adults of this world?
Thank you.
you stole my question. Can I just add, because as a way of concluding, what I was trying to ask is, I mean, in one of your papers that I had the pleasure to read, which was about environmental deregulation, racism, and white nationalism, you're kind of saying in your conclusion, white supremacy has been impeding the progressive changes at the local and national level. And I was wondering whether you actually think this is also the case at the global scale. And if you think so, and this is where I was thinking, like, what can people outside the U.S., a combination of, what can students and also people outside the U.S. who don't have the right to vote anyway in the U.S. elections, what can you do about it?
In the U.S., I always tell people the number one thing we can do is we can, especially it's important, I think, for people who are white identified, who pass as white, is like to be doing anti-racist work in the white community. So I think it's enormously important to do that kind of work. So that's the first thing, but y'all aren't here, they're in the United States. So I think it's important, but we do know that the right is growing in many different parts of the world, including here in the UK, which I don't have much to comment on because I don't know enough about it. But I think it's really important to be actively engaged in those issues and challenging the right, and thinking about, here's one of the things I will say, don't allow your country to get as polarized as us. That polarization is like, that's a death spiral, you know? Nothing good's gonna come of that. And so, I don't know what we could have done to avert that polarization. Maybe it was not possible to avert it, but really work to avert that polarization. I would say that's super important. Well, at the same time, working to, you know, actively working for climate action and to challenging, you know, your own levels of different kinds of supremacies and biases that exist in the different countries that you come from. I know they're different in different places.
Okay, I guess that will be the moment for us to conclude today. So can I just remind you also again that this is the first part of the new lecture series that Department of Geography and Environment has launched, a Sustainability Public Lecture Series. The second lecture will be on the 3rd of February, which is going to be given by Professor Edward Barbier from the Colorado State University, who is a world-renowned environmental economist, and he is going to visit and deliver the talk. So please stay tuned and wait for the announcement. Thank you everyone who joined us today in this lecture theater, and especially many thanks to Laura for finding time to come and deliver your talk. Really enjoyed it. Thank you.